the Thursday, March 22nd, 2012 meeting of the House of Representatives Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee will come to order. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chairman Cornish?
Here.
Vice Chairman Woodard?
Here.
Representative Mullery?
Here.
Representative Dowd?
Here.
Representative Gauthier? Representative Grunhagen?
Here.
Representative Hilty?
Here.
Representative Johnson? Representative Kelly? Representative Kiefer?
Here.
Representative Kreisel?
Here.
Representative Leidiger?
Here.
Representative Mariani? Representative McDonald? Representative Moran? Representative Nornes?
Here.
Representative Slocum?
Here.
Representative Smith?
The quorum is present. Representative Dowd, would you like to move the minutes of the March 20 meeting?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dowd moves the approval of the March 20 minutes. Are there any corrections? Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. The first bill on the agenda is House File 2220. Representative Poppy, are you ready to present your bill?
Yes.
All right, the chair will move that House File 2220 is heard before the committee. Representative Poppy, will you begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. House File 2220 came about because of a horrific situation in Maurer County involving two young boys and their parents. With me today, I have testifiers who will describe what the situation was, how egregious it was, and what they would hope the hope for outcome. The bill brief does explain what the change is. Currently, the statute was limited in how the parents could be treated, and the consequences for the parents for using extreme and prolonged child restraint, which led to demonstrable bodily harm, was limited in what they could be charged. So this is what the situation is. I have with me today a variety of people. I have the sheriff. I have a Maurer County detective, I have a social worker, and I have an assistant county attorney. They each are going to describe the part they played in this situation and the reason behind this bill. So I'm going to turn it over first to the social worker, and she will be able to introduce herself and move forward.
Go ahead. Whoever would like to proceed, your name and title.
I'm Gail Lovering, and I work with Maurer County Human Services. I'm a social worker, and I do child protection investigations and assessments. In April of 2011, I was assigned to complete an assessment in regards to a report of a child reporting to his preschool teacher that he had been chained to the bed. Went to the preschool, met with this little tiny guy who was five at the time, but presented more as a three-year-old, very underweight. Physically presented younger and developmentally presented younger. I talked with him for a little bit. What I normally do is kind of get to know the child, and we talk about pets and all of that. And during the discussion, asked him what his nightly routine is, and he made the comment that he normally, puts his pajamas on, and then he goes to bed, and then mommy puts on the chain. And the reason this report even came in is because we had a preschool teacher who was talking to her group of students about the big thunderstorm the night before, and if they liked the storms and the rain and all of that. And this little guy had mentioned that he got very, very scared because he didn't know how he would get out of his house or out of his bed if a storm or a tornado or we had a fire. And the teacher said, well, wouldn't you just, call your mommy and daddy? And he said, well, I do. And she said, well, do they come to your bed? Well, sometimes they do. Well, then why don't you just get up and go to your mommy and daddy? Well, I can't because of the chain. And, you go into these assessments thinking, okay, you've got a five-year-old sometimes. He drew the chain. He drew the fence around his bed. He showed me the ankle, where the chain was attached. And it was very, very evident that his biggest fear was not being able to escape if there was a fire or a tornado or a storm, because there was no way for him to get away from that bed. From that point on, I normally will contact our investigator, who is Detective Sandvik, and I'll let him continue from that point.
Sir, if you state your name and title, and go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Steve Sandvik, a sergeant investigator with the Maurer County Sheriff's Office. As Gail had explained, it was April 21st. She and I went to the home to make contact. And just to make it clear, pictures don't do it justice. We are here asking for one word to be changed. One word. From substantial to demonstrable. This five-year-old child was chained with this very chain and those padlocks to his bed from the time he came home till the time he went to school the next day. A crime that if anybody else did that to any other child or any other adult would be a felony. Because his own parents did this to him, the worst that could happen to them criminally was a gross misdemeanor with the ability to do sentence to service to shorten their sentence further. 6 months in jail was the punishment they received. We're asking to change one word in a statute to close an egregious and albeit rare loophole to offer some justice for any future children who suffered this kind of abuse. The stench in the room that day was as if an anhydrous tank had sprung a leak. These children were not allowed out of the room to go to the bathroom. The crib in the pictures you see had the front gate removed. The chain, as we walked in that day, was attached to the bars on the crib. The child with his leg attached to the bars would have had approximately 2 to 3 inches movement total. He was unable to roll over. He had no toys to play with. The wood that you see on the bottom of the bed was swollen and stained and reeked of urine. The conditions were absolutely horrific, yet this five-year-old child looked at Gail and I and was proud to show us his bedroom. He had no concept that every other child in the world was not treated the same way. None. They had no concept of parents reading with children, parents playing with children. All of these things were so horrific, it amounted to torture. And the horror of it continues for these kids, and it will for many, many years. To think that there is such a large loophole that would prevent us from applying the necessary and correct punishment is atrocious to me. This loophole needs to be closed. We're not asking for anything more than changing one word. For this crime to have been a felony, that child would have had to have broken bones or permanent disfigurement. Within our timelines, we can't prove that on a mental anguish basis. That actually takes years to come out through prolonged therapy. The doctors, when we took the kids to the hospital, were only able to check bodily harm. Meaning the doctors could see the swelling, the doctors could see the bruising, the doctors could see where the rust stains from the chain were permanently embossed into this child's ankle. The chrome at the end of the chain where the child's leg was is rubbed off. To give you an idea of how long this has gone on, this is a hardened steel welded link chain. Thank you.
I'm Krista Van Gundy. Can everyone hear me okay? Generally loud enough in the courtroom. I'm an assistant Mower County attorney. I am in the criminal division and was responsible for both the criminal prosecution of the parents in this particular matter, as well as sitting second chair on the termination trial. And on the second termination trial, I sat first chair for terminating the parental rights in this particular matter. When this matter did come into the county attorney's office, let me be clear that we searched the statutes to try to find a felony to charge these parents with. The acts that were committed here are egregious. If they were done to any adult or to anyone else's child, it is a felony under the statute.
the loophole is that you can do this to your own child and only be charged with a gross misdemeanor. We charged these parents, both of them, with actually four counts of gross misdemeanors, malicious punishment, as well as the unreasonable restraint. In both circumstances, the parents pled to two gross misdemeanors. They were given the maximum sentence allowable under the statute by Judge Rashavi. At his sentencing hearing for these parents, his exact quote was that a home should be a home, not a concentration camp. He was deeply disturbed, as was Judge Wellman, for the child protection matter, with the behavior that went on here. They simply had nothing available to them either. For these parents, they were given a sentence of 365 days under the gross misdemeanor maximum sentence. Those sentences were run consecutive. 1 year was executed with 1 year stayed so that we could have probation on these parents and be able to control what they do. If we executed the maximum sentence available, the 2 years consecutive, we would have had no tie to these parents or no way to ensure that they went through treatment as would be appropriate for these parents. Because they were eligible for sentence to service, because they were eligible to work their time, they only served 6 months. We simply need the change in the statute in order to give justice to these children when these acts are committed by their own parents, as opposed to a daycare provider or someone else's parent. This case is rare. We'll admit that. I think Sheriff will tell you that in her career she's rarely seen a case like this. But I can tell you that when we went looking for statutes that would apply to this case, we called larger counties, we called larger child protection divisions to see if there was anything, any creative way that they had to deal with this problem. Their answer was no. They've looked, they've searched. It's happened to them that they've had cases like this, and they simply were unable to deal with them. I know there's some concern with respect to dealing with this matter and some unintended consequences that might exist. We're talking about a statute that talks specifically already about cruel, unusual, unreasonable, prolonged restraint of a child that involves caging, chaining, that kind of behavior. We're not talking about child tethering. We're not talking about child harnesses. We're talking about the situation that Detective Sandvik described, one where this child's entire life revolved around that crib and that bed. He no longer had a mattress because he, in his boredom, he picked at it because it was the only thing available to him, and the parents took that away. He had no concept of an outside world. He had white walls. If you look at those pictures, there's nothing to look at. This child was confined the majority of his life by this chain to that crib. And his brother was very proud to tell you he didn't need this anymore because he learned. He learned he wasn't supposed to get out of the bed. The parents in their testimony at the CHIPS trial stated they heard something moving around the house. They weren't sure if it was the kids or the cat. This is what they resorted to. They were too lazy to get up and check to see what was moving around. This circumstance is egregious. You should not be allowed to do this to your own children when you're not allowed to do it to somebody else's.
As Krista Van Gundy, our assistant county attorney, said,
your name and
title. I'm Therese Amazai, Mower County Sheriff.
Okay.
And I've been with Mower County for 23 years. I have 25 years of law enforcement experience, and this is by far the worst case that I've ever seen, as far as child abuse and the confinement of a child. We don't get many of these cases, thankfully, but we are asking for your help in moving this forward and getting this one word changed. And certainly we'll be able to answer any of your questions should you feel free to ask us those things.
Representative Pompey, what's the status right now in the Senate? And then the other question would be, do you have any formal support by the County Attorney's Association or the Sheriff's Association?
Right now, the status in the Senate, the bill has been introduced. It's not yet gotten a hearing. Okay. But I will ask the Sheriff and the County Attorney to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did ask the Sheriff's Association for their support, and they gave it without question. Yes.
Okay, and County Attorneys Association?
Mr. Kingery, I believe, was here, if he isn't still here, and yes, they are supportive of this legislation.
Have they taken a formal... Mr. Kingery, could you come down for a second?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Kingery, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Our board reviewed this bill a couple of times, and at their January meeting this year, they did vote to support this legislation.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kreisel, followed by Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question's for whoever. Under the current law, were you able to remove the children from the home and at least get them someplace safe? And, you know, it's a horrible story, so I'm hoping that the kids were able to be removed.
Absolutely. Representative Kreisel, they were removed immediately, taken to a medical facility for examinations, which is where the pictures of the child's ankle were taken. As standard practice with all child abuse cases, children were examined, they were placed on a 72-hour hold, and the CHIPS process was begun. I guess some of the unusual things with this were the isolation these children suffered, that they didn't know that this was unusual. And the preciousness of it all, at the end of his physical examination at the hospital, before going to foster care, standard practice I have with all children, as does Gail, is answer any of their questions. The only question asked was, are you going to take the chain, and will anybody chain me again?
The matter now has been completed through a trial. Actually, we have two trials for termination of parental rights. This is an ICWA case, Indian Child Welfare case, and as a result, after the first termination trial, the tribe, which is the Cherokee Nation, from Oklahoma, were unable to say that active efforts had been made, as is required under ICWA. After the second trial, which occurred approximately 30 days ago, I believe, the tribe was able to say that active efforts have been made. Judge Wellman issued his order last Thursday terminating the parental rights of the parents with respect to these children. However, we received yesterday the appeal from the parents, and so we'll be going through that process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Poppy. Yeah, if there is some problem with lowering the threshold down to demonstrable, what would be a good definition of demonstrable harm to the way it sits now?
May I answer that?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, there is a definition of demonstrable bodily harm that's already used. Statute 609.2231, which is the fourth degree assault statute, uses in every single subdivision of that statute the word demonstrable bodily harm. It's talking about harm to peace officers, EMTs, correctional officers, utility workers, postal workers. That's the statute that covers any assault to those particular individuals. It defines demonstrable bodily harm in the JIG, as well as in case law since 1984, as bodily harm means that it is capable of being perceived by a person other than the victim. And that's the definition that's used or was applied through case law. In this particular circumstance, we wouldn't have had that. I believe you all have the photographs of the rust stain that was around the boy's leg that would have been harm that could be perceived by another individual, in this case by the doctor, as well as the swelling that was present.
And bruising as well.
and there's no fiscal note on this?
There's no fiscal impact.
Okay. Well, I mean, I meant fiscal, in fact. Yeah, there is a fiscal, no, but come back. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And please excuse me for being late, so I'm trying to catch up. So are we moving this from a gross misdemeanor to a felony for any demonstrable, which is signs of abuse,
yes.
Physical abuse?
That's
correct.
Representative Moran, I think what we're going to do is hold a bill over today. And I just feel because we haven't vetted this out enough, I'm a little uncomfortable with that definition, plus it isn't moving anywhere in the Senate, it sounds like. Representative Poppy, if you could get this to move in the Senate and actually have somebody talk to me that it has a future and they're interested in something, we could possibly look at an amendment to it that a bill here in the future or something. I just don't want to progress it today without knowing that and then without talking more about this definition. But I would be willing to do something with it if we could get some assurance from the Senate that something's going to happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will speak with my senator. I will encourage him to do what he can, and perhaps maybe he will also want to speak with you to see how we could make that happen.
Okay. Representative, anybody else have any questions? Well, thank you much for your testimony. And Representative Leidiger, you have
one? Well, I didn't know how far you wanted to pursue this in this committee, Mr. Chair. But I keep reading the sentence over again, and I'm curious why we weren't able to, in this case, under the word substantial bodily harm. I guess I'd really have to understand that definition too. But in this case, it seems like you had substantial bodily harm. What is the definition of substantial then?
Substantial bodily harm involves the breaking of a bone or the temporary loss of a bodily member or organ, meaning there would have had to be additional injury to the child. He would have had to have broken a bone, had some sort of injury to eye, liver, stomach, those kinds of things. Substantial bodily harm is quite a high threshold.
Whereas it would be a temporary impairment of an organ, or and then great bodily harm would be permanent, I mean.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay,
members.
Thank you.
No other questions. Representative Poppe, any closing remarks?
This is an egregious case. It is a rare situation. It is extremely, as you understood from the testimony, it is something that will live with all of the people that were witness to it and have been with the children. It's something that's going to be with these children for a long time. It's a serious situation, and we'd like to see the remedy, and we appreciate the time of the committee today, and I'm hopeful that perhaps we can move something very quickly here, because it's a serious situation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you folks very much for your testimony. The bill will be temporarily laid over. Representative Quam, you in the building here? House File 2128, and Representative Woodard, would you fill in?
I'm told that former Representative K.J. McDonald is in the committee room. Just want to recognize you, Representative McDonald, for all of your service. And hopefully you can have more influence over your son. Okay, Representative Quam, is there any, do we have any other, I'll just move it. Representative Quam, I will move House File 2128, recommend its passage, and sent to the General Register. Representative Quam, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a fairly straightforward updating, modernization, and conformity for the EMS services. And what it's been a few years, and so names, titles, and terminology have changed, definitions, and some of the nationally recognized curriculum and coursework have shifted some. So this is just a update. I do have testifiers if there are questions on specific areas.
Okay, thank you, Representative Quam. And Ms. Isabilado?
That's correct, Mr.
Okay. Please state your name officially for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pam Bilodeau. I'm the Executive Director for the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, and I'm here representing our board today. And I'm not sure how much information you would like. There's five areas that really are the areas of the update for the housekeeping bill. and it's mostly related to the new education standards. Minnesota's adopted the National Highway Transportation and Safety Administration standards, which became effective in 2012. And one thing I would like to stress is that most of the educational programs that we approve are already teaching or at or above the new standards. Those five areas, and I should mention that this is in talking with our partners, we've canvassed different associations, and our board members, we have 19 representing a wide range throughout the state of Minnesota and professions, in addition to a 25-member work group of educators. And we have not heard that from anyone that this would be controversial in any way, and we are not noting any fiscal note. The areas, as I mentioned, are with the National Education Standards. The second one is the Radio Communication Plan. We're simply updating and pointing to the State of Minnesota Department of Public Safety Division. It's the Emergency Communications Network, and it's their standards, and we're simply aligning the communication radio plan. The third one is disciplinary actions, and that's a simple update. It includes assault, theft, violating substance laws that has the potential to harm the public. The fourth is procedures and equipment, and that's updating procedures and equipment, such as adding commercially manufactured tourniquets and moving language that was in rule to standard. And the fifth one, it just simply aligns the definitions. And I stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Bildu. And just a quick question. How does this impact the volunteer first responders?
The volunteer first responders, the one thing that I'd like to mention about the new curriculum is that it's not hour-based, whereas the old curriculum was. So being evidence-based, showing that you have competency, it could actually lower, especially with refreshers. So if you come into it knowing AEDs and CPR already, which a lot of people do, then you have the opportunity now to show competency in that area rather than go through the hour-based for initial and refresher. So it gives a little bit more latitude, especially in rural areas where maybe they see something more than other areas, and then they can go toward giving renewal or refreshers in those areas.
Okay. Any questions from members for Ms. Bildu? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, Ms. Bildu. And
thank you,
Mr. McAlpin as well. And state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, Buck McAlpin. I represent the Minnesota Ambulance Association today. Ms. Bildu covered it pretty well. And the Ambulance Association has worked the last few years before Ms. Bildu even came on as executive director on this legislation to come up with the national conformity. And I know there's been questions asked about the training standards and the length of time. Most of our first responder stuff in Minnesota is voluntary. I also work for North Memorial. We train the State Patrol and medical direct the State Patrol. So much of what we're catching up to, the Representative Quam talked about earlier, we've actually been teaching in our system the last few years with the State Patrol and many of our partners in the system that provide us first responder services. Our association endorsed it early, and we had many work groups around the state that we attended with the EMS Regulatory Board to get members to, from fire services, small first responder squads, large services, if any of them had questions about how this was going to roll out. So we've definitely supported moving this forward.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. Any questions from members? Okay, any testimony in favor of or in opposition to the bill from the public? Seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 2128 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Quam. Let's see, next up we have DPS. The Governor's Supplemental Budget Recommendations. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hyde.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members.
And please state your name for the record for us.
For the record, my name is Chris Idy. I am the Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management with the Department of Public Safety. And if you'll bear with me a minute here. Okay. My computer went to sleep.
And Ms. Heidi, a reminder to members that this is in your packets, the supplemental budget from MMB as well. So go ahead, Ms. Heidi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little background of the disaster that we're asking a deficiency for is this is what we call DR 1900. That's a FEMA number given to all the disasters that are presidentially declared. This is actually the spring floods from 2010. You may recall that was a very long process for that, from the beginning of the melt to the end of the melt, that our incident period started March 1st and it ended April 26th of 2010. Governor Pawlenty at the time requested a declaration on April 6th, which, as you can see from the timeline, was very, very early, and some of our areas up in the northwest corner were not yet melted. President Obama declared this a major disaster on April 19th. It was for 26 counties and 2 tribal communities and was for public assistance only. Public assistance is for the public infrastructure damage and emergency response costs. The original declaration was on April 19th, but then we added 18 for the 18 counties and 1 tribal community, excuse me. We added on 6 counties on May 4th and 1 tribal community. And the reason that we add on is because, as I said earlier, that there might not actually be damage, or you might not get to the area yet because it is flooded, or as in the case of the Northwest, it hadn't flooded yet, but we knew as the spring melt came through that it would be flooding. Then on May 28th, we added 1 more county, and the last county that was added on was all the way in June 29th. This is what we ended up with, as you can see from this blurry picture, is that we go all the way from Kitson County in the northwest, down the Red River, down the Minnesota River, across the Mississippi River, ending the flooding in the Twin Cities area. The financial information on this: the original damage assessment was $14,763,209. We have joint preliminary damage assessment teams that are with FEMA and with the state and with the local unit of government. We go to many of the places that were damaged. The engineers take a look at it, take a look at what kinds of repairs may be needed, estimate the amount of damage and the amount of money that it would cost to repair. This damage assessment was done early in the disaster. It was during the regular legislative session. So we had 2 bills on the House side, 3795, and on the Senate side, 3379, asking for the state to pay the full 25% non-federal share, which at that point was $3,691,000. Those bills were passed and signed by Governor Pawlenty on May 25th. The current situation is that the communities are continuing to repair bridges, roads, culverts, improving some of them so that they don't get the same type of damage in the future. So when we declare early in the disaster, do the damage assessment, ask for the 25% match, and continue to add on those counties, and as the water recedes, you find additional damages, the actual damage ends up exceeding our original assessments. So far, we've actually processed $12,491,529 of the federal share to date, so we have then also paid the state share with that, which when we always pay the state share on the back end after the federal share has been paid. So all of our state match of $3,691,000 has been encumbered or expended, and we have a projected deficiency for this fiscal year for $235,000, and that is what is in the governor's supplemental budget. At this point, I'm open to questions.
Members, any questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We'll let you off easy today. Appreciate the information, though.
You bet.
Commissioner Densky, you're here today to talk about the safety soft body armor reimbursement and tell us probably how that relates to your share and the federal share and how that's handled. Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members. Mark Densky, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Public Safety. And I'll be very brief. As many of you have heard the term a bulletproof vest on television or other places, in reality, most of these vests actually aren't bulletproof, but they do offer a significant amount of protection to the wearer against common small and medium firearm rounds. We often, in Minnesota statute, we often hear, and you hear on television and in Minnesota statute, refer to these vests, and I did bring one along today. And if the chair would like it to be passed around, that's fine. We refer to these vests in statute as soft body armor. Soft body armor is designed to stop a bullet from penetrating and causing harm to the wearer. They're actually made of a number of panels held together in a vest. If you feel that, there's some panels that are alongside of it. And in the very chest area, there's a hard ceramic and metal piece. The panels are constructed in many layers of incredibly strong fiber, typically Kevlar, which when hit act as kind of a net, kind of a tight woven soccer net, that essentially catches the bullet, prevents it from traveling any further. Each layer twists as the bullet passes through, creating a stronger barrier and slowing the bullet until it comes to a complete stop. This process deforms the bullet, flattening it into a dish or a mushroom shape, and the force of the impact is spread over a larger portion of the vest. Although the vest will stop the penetration of the bullet, the wearer still absorbs the bullet's full energy. This impact may be enough to cause what's commonly referred to as blunt force trauma at the point of impact. And you probably heard of people who, individuals who actually have been shot by a firearm actually being knocked off their feet and actually being knocked out or losing their wind because of the impact of the bullet. And while that blunt force trauma is undoubtedly very painful, it's typically not life-threatening. As a matter of fact, the vest that you're seeing here, in addition to rounds, the vest that you see there belonged to a state trooper. It actually expired in 1990. It's an old vest. It was a replacement vest that he received in 1983. He was standing outside of a crash on Highway 12, was struck by an automobile, thrown over that automobile into the hood and windshield of the subsequent vehicle. The manufacturer of the vest declared him a vest survivor, and they issued him a replacement vest, which that is. He did suffer significant trauma to the lower part of his body, but his internal organs held up pretty well, and they attributed it to the fact that he was wearing the vest. Because of the effectiveness of the soft body armor, today many law enforcement officers in Minnesota wear them, and they are in fact mandated wear equipment by many law enforcement organizations here in the state. The soft body armor or vest reimbursement program was established in Minnesota Statute 299A.38 in 1989. It served to offset law enforcement officers and law enforcement organizations for a portion of the purchase of soft body armor vests. The Commissioner of Public Safety was designated as a point of application for reimbursement and given the fiduciary responsibility for the established reimbursement fund. In 2005, the legislature established that $508,000 be allocated annually to this reimbursement fund. That amount has remained constant each fiscal year. Since its inception, statutory language has limited the amount of reimbursement per individual. In the 2005 language change, the allowable reimbursement was amended to the lesser of $600 or 50% of the actual purchase price. Additionally, the 2005 change added language instructing the Commissioner of Public Safety to adjust that $600 threshold by an annual percentage change in the Consumer Price Index. Based on that escalator, the maximum reimbursement amount to individuals has climbed from $600 in 2005 to $696 in 2011. And while the inflation escalator was added to the maximum amount of the reimbursement in 2005, there have been no increases in the dedicated fund. For comparison, if a similar consumer price index information and escalator were used, the dedicated fund would have grown incrementally from $508,000 in 2005 to approximately $663,000 in 2011. In recent years, the fund has been completely expended prior to the end of the fiscal year. Qualified reimbursements have been delayed until the fund was reallocated in the subsequent fiscal years, only to be expended prior to the completion of that fiscal year. This year, the fund was depleted after only 4 months. In the middle of October, the fund was completely depleted. As of this morning, the Department of Public Safety is holding 777 backlog soft body armor reimbursement requests. With the anticipated requests for the remainder of this fiscal year, it's estimated that a one-time appropriation of $515,000 is needed to bring the account to balance for the beginning of next fiscal year. And that $515,000 is included in the governor's supplemental budget request.
Thank you, sir. Any questions from members? Does the you might have touched on this, but does the commissioner, does the most of the vests still have a wear out like 5 years, or is it changed from vest to vest maker?
The Mr. Chair, nationally, the Department of Justice, through their process of certifying the vests, have come up with a recommendation to vest because of the normal wear and tear on vests that they replaced on a 5-year cycle. And that's where Minnesota statute allows for a 5-year replacement of vests.
Sometimes it's kind of a complicated procedure to go through. I know in our department, they had the vest reimbursement program, and the state paid a share, and the feds paid a share. And you're not necessarily going to get it right away. Sometimes you had to pay for it up front and then being reimbursed later. And then I think the federal guidelines indicated that certain type of vests you couldn't buy. They had to be from the approved list, and there's something to weed through. But it is a good program because these things, when I started, you would get a good vest for $100 and a quarter, and now they're all the way $600 on up, I suppose. I don't know. Some of them get up towards $1,000, don't they?
Mr. Chair, the average reimbursement now in our half, up to half, is the average reimbursement is just under $500, about $496. And so on average, vests will run anywhere from $900 upwards to $1,400 or $1,500 and some beyond, depending. There are some sizing and some fitting that goes along with them, but they have become rather expensive.
And remember, Second Chance used to put out a bulletin, maybe they still do, but it would show you the pictures of the officers and tell a short story, and it would show them with their bare chest and this great big hematoma bruise where sometimes they'd even break a rib, but they would live through it. And so, all right. Representative Nornes.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, just a question dealing with the vest that came around here. I was surprised how heavy it was. Are the new vests... are they about the same weight? It seems like if you're running after somebody, you need to be in pretty good shape with that extra weight on you. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative, the new vests are somewhat lighter, but in fact, the chair would probably point out that that is one of the issues that law enforcement officers have, is that they are an additional piece of equipment that you're wearing. They do add weight. In the summertime, they are very uncomfortable. The vest that was passed around did actually have an armor plate that was an option. It's a ceramic metal plate that's in the front. Some officers choose not to wear that because that does add a significant amount of weight as well. But, in fact, it does protect the vital parts of your organ, and it does give you added protection. But they are uncomfortable.
For some of the departments that have the mandatory wear, I think it tends to keep the officers in better shape because you get somebody that's just huge, and we've all seen them. it's really tough then. Get a special vest, and then the uncomfortable ability of wearing it makes you not want to wear it, and then you're kind of defeating the purpose. But any other questions? Thank you very much, Commissioner, for your presentation. Hopefully you can keep this program funded. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's see. Just some closing remarks. This probably is our last meeting unless something gets referred to us through the Rules Committee and we have to come back under an emergency or something, or there's a national or state disaster. But I just wanted to thank everybody on both sides. I wanted to thank DFL members. I wish they all could have been here at a going-away party here for them. But thank you, Representative Hilty, for your service here and all these years and the way you've conducted yourself. We really appreciate your... I think we had a really good committee. I hope you noticed that I tried to ask the DFL side each time we had an amendment or a procedure if it was okay with you first, and I think that's kind of the reason that our committee, unlike some others, aren't meeting at nights or on Fridays. We were able to get along together, and we had our political differences sometimes, but at least we're able to keep charging and moving and sending our bills on, even though some of them maybe we shouldn't have sent on. So thank you very much, and Representative Moran, and thank you, folks, and for everything you've done. And Representative Kriesel, I want to thank you not only naturally for your service here, but your service for our country, of course, and the way you've conducted yourself. And you weren't just a rubber stamp for the party. You stood up for your convictions, and we appreciated that, even though it might have frustrated some. And thank you very much. And since I'm old, we wrote this down so I wouldn't forget. I want to thank also the nonpartisan researchers, Mr. Diebel, Ms. Perius, and Jim Cleary. Thank you very much. And our partisan researchers, Dennis Verdson and Katie Weeks, and our committee administrator, John Hultquist, and our committee legislative assistant, Pete Sparby, John Walsh, our fiscal analyst, House Information Media writer, Mike Cook, our pages, Tom Oskop and Mike Nelson, and the staff at the Sergeant of Arms office, and the handsome security guys in the red coats. Any of them back there? Or? And that's always nice to have those folks around. One thing that was impressive that day when that interesting individual started throwing out the papers and yelling and hollering, it was about all of a sudden there was six troopers standing around. So we sure appreciate the security and the staff security here and the troopers being around. And Karen Rudin, in case she's watching somewhere on TV or listening, we thank her for minding the office while we have been in committee down here. So, did I forget anybody? I hope
just
not.
You.
Huh?
Just you.
Oh, ha. Well, thank you, folks. I sure appreciate it. And until we meet again, we'll adjourn the meeting and wait for.
Yeah. Only if needed will we meet tomorrow.
Oh, only if needed will we meet tomorrow. So just kind of watch your emails. And yes, Representative Grunheim.
Yeah, we do want to thank you for your leadership and for your correction and encouragement and direction of ourselves and the justice that you bring. Fairness is people that support that.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you very
That's
much.
Why your wife deals with justice, not fairness.
All right. Any other comments or concerns? So what? Huh? Oh, where's the group from in the back?
Oh, there.
What?
I was just talking.
What did they say?
Blue Cross. Blue Cross Blue Shield. Oh. Yeah, we missed some of the good testimony.
Yeah. What they're with her.
Oh, they're with you?
Well, I don't know if they want to claim me, but I was chatting with them upstairs.
Oh, okay.
So.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for being here. I hope you enjoyed yourself watching sausage being made. All right. Meeting is adjourned.